Welcome, welcome. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In, the first episode of The Lock-In, sponsored by Paddy Power Poker and Poker Stars. I'm David Lappin, alongside Darragh O'Kearney, of course. Darragh O'Kearney, actually, should I call you Paddy Power Poker Ambassador Darragh O'Kearney, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. This is our first show, as you said, under our new sponsors. We love our new Flutter Overlords, and we have a really top-notch guest to get things going.
Yeah, we certainly do. Joining us this week is high stakes poker player, coach and strategy writer. His Punt of the Day series has been the best thing to happen to poker strategy writing since your books, of course, Dara. He is Sam Greenwood. Sam, welcome to The Lock-In.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So great to have you on. Sam, you have received, it's fair to say, a lot of praise for the Punt of the Day. As a poker player who clearly had an itch to scratch, shall we say, a creative itch to scratch specifically, is this project saving you, or is it giving you maybe more impetus to do more in the content creation space?
The impetus for me in the content creation space is just that I have a two-year-old, a soon-to-be two-year-old, and then a soon-to-be newborn, and traveling. You know, even now, I'm, as of today, March 11th, 11:25 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, I'm not planning on going to Trident Jeju, but I was also like looking at flights, like just before this started, and then I'm like, well, then I need to get a, I'll be gone for 3 weeks. I need to get a babysitter. My wife's pregnant. Knock on wood, the winter has taken a step back in Toronto, but like if it gets colder, gets snowier again, then my wife needs to take a toddler to daycare at like a blizzard. I don't want to force her to do that. So all of that to say is like that was kind of more the impetus of like, how can I stay connected and keep my poker mind sharp and actually create something structured when life has sort of made it much harder for me to actually play. That's kind of what I was going. And then I found I really enjoyed it, but yeah, it is a lot of, it's a lot of work. There's a thing about poker, which is if you do a bad job playing in a given day, it's over. You don't need to go back and fix your mistakes. If I have an unproductive or bad day writing, I'm like, well, I still need to publish it. I still need to fix it. There's no, so it's been, I think that's been the big thing with me psychologically, how it's given me this thing where like, you need to complete a task and you need to do a good job. You know, so much of about playing poker is about having a short memory. And so much of this is about having sort of like a long memory and being detail oriented and correcting your mistakes, not just psychologically, but like literally, like, you know, people put up a post and somebody will say, you said the board was jack high and it was 10 high. And I have this rush of embarrassment over me and like run to my computer and like fix it. You know, it's a whole other different game.
Now, Dara, turning to you, obviously we made, I don't know what to call it, a similar decision because neither of us have played at the level of Sam, but you've played at a very, very high level, higher than I, and we definitely made a conscious decision to move into the content creation space a decade or so ago, and you've obviously diversified further into more coaching and other stuff too. Now, anybody who watches your Instagram will see that you're still playing quite a lot of online poker and live poker as well, but like, can you relate to what Sam's talking about there, just about maybe like whether it's a stage of life, whether it's the way the game has changed, like what motivated you specifically back then 10 years ago to similarly, you know, nudge yourself that direction?
Yeah, I mean, you make it sound like a conscious decision, but I'm not sure that it really was. Just kind of the way that my mind has always operated, while I get very obsessed about whatever my main current obsession is, I'm also sort of a bit of a dilettante when it comes to, like, I like to do lots of different things rather than focus just on one thing. And when I got into poker, and I did absolutely love playing, particularly online. But, you know, I also thought, okay, well, I should play live. And then within a couple of years, I was sponsored and I thought, well, I need to do other stuff. I was writing a blog. And at the start, it was really just sort of to give me something else to focus on, something else to do so that I wasn't just playing. And almost none of my income at the start came from the other thing. But what happened over time is, online poker became tougher. Win rates went down. You were competing with more and more studied players. So, and at the same time, the other stuff became more lucrative. Coaching, writing, the content creation in general. And also the industry shifted from a sort of you win a big tournament, you get sponsored by a big site, to you write a blog that a lot of people read, or you create a vlog that a lot of people watch, or you create a podcast a lot of people listen to, and now you get sponsored. So the incentive has essentially changed over time. And I used to always think of, like, I used to tell people back in the people used to say to me, like, why do you bother writing your blog? Why do you bother doing all the other stuff you do? How much do you actually make from that? And I used to say, well, it's probably about 5% of my income. But I do it, as much as a hobby as anything else, just to be doing something different. But then over time, I do remember the point at which suddenly I realized, wow, at least half my money is now coming from the other stuff rather than my online play. And in recent years, that's continued to grow even more, so that now playing poker online is a smaller and smaller part of the picture. And I'm no longer relying on playing online. Like, I don't even worry about downswings anymore because I barely even notice them. Because I'm not, well, for one thing, I'm not playing high enough that the amounts are going to be absolutely massive. But most of my income is coming from the other stuff these days. And to be honest, like, I do enjoy all the other stuff. It's funny in a way, because the thing I enjoy the most is still playing online. And that's why I do so much of it, even though I don't have the same financial incentive I used to. But when I have dipped my toes in a few things in the poker space and thought, no, I just don't really enjoy this. So I've just basically stopped it. But I really enjoy coaching. I really enjoy the content creation. I really enjoy the writing with Barry, and all the other stuff I do. I enjoy the occasional commentary I do with you and others. So it's all just sort of to make my life more diverse, I think.
Yeah, I can relate to that. And actually, that brings us very nicely to our first topic, which is all about Brad Owen and a recent tweet a couple of weeks ago. Brad, obviously a very famous cash game player, vlogger, plays tournaments these days as well. He opened up about what I guess you could describe as a pretty tough stretch in his career, revealing a significant downswing and some deeper frustrations with both the poker and the content creation side of the industry. In a long post on Twitter, it was one of those, you had to pay extra to be allowed write an essay. He said he's currently down around 400K since the start of 2024's World Series, including roughly 100K downswing already in 2026. He said the majority of those losses have come from mixed game tournaments. In recent years, he's been pushing himself to chase a major title, which meant stepping into some of the tougher mixed game events at the World Series and in other places. I think he played the 50K Poker Players Championship once or twice already. While Owen said that he could easily return to playing cash, where he's historically been much more consistent, he admitted that he's reluctant to give up the challenge of competing for a big tournament win. That pursuit, however, has come with significant mental pressure, it would seem. In the post, he spoke very candidly about feeling like he's losing his identity during the downswing and struggling with the expectations he puts on himself as a poker player, content creator, ambassador, partner, and father. Despite the current difficulties, Owen noted that he's still up about £1 million from poker over the past 2 decades, and that works out to around 50K a year from playing. Obviously, that doesn't include revenue from his YouTube channel, sponsorships, and business ventures too. So, he's doing okay, I suppose, is what we can take from that. Dara, to start with you this time, Brad laid himself bare in this tweet, which went super viral. It can't have been an easy thing to post, but there's a strong sense that he did it as a, shall we say, catharsis of sorts, almost for his own mental well-being. What did you make of it when you first read it?
Yeah, it did feel very cathartic and also very honest, and I think that's not surprising coming from Brad. Brad has always come across as somebody who's incredibly authentic. We all get to, curate our image to a certain extent, but with Brad, you got the feeling that he was essentially communicating the truth of his experience. as he moved to poker as a content creator. And I think that's why he did so well. It really resonated with a lot of people. He gave people a lot of insight into a world that they were interested in, and he had credibility because they felt that he was actually telling the truth. This is the other side of telling the truth. Like when you're on a downswing, it's difficult. It's always a balancing act because, you know, sometimes people say to me, "Oh, you're always winning because you only post brag tweets about, you know, when your latest Irish Open seed or whatever." That's not completely true, but it is true that I don't post bad beats. I mean, nobody ever wants to read a bad beat. People actually prefer, the vast majority of people actually like good news stories, and that's something which isn't always easy to recognize because most of the stories that go viral are actually bad news stories in some way, cheating scandals or something like that. But the other side of that is, on the few occasions where I have sort of had something major to deal with and I've written about it in my blog, the reaction has been very, very good, and it's been very cathartic for me too. So I relate to Brad on that level. You know, I remember when I wrote my blog about my wife and myself struggles with our son's autism, that sort of went viral even outside of poker. And you know, people are also open to that as well. You know, people like to have the feeling that they're hearing the true story, rather than a sort of a, you know, we all live in the Instagram world now where people only eat great meals and hang out with great people and never have any bad times. And that's not the reality.
Indeed. Well, over to you, Sam. Beyond his personal struggles, eloquently described in the, in this piece, Brad also used the post to reflect on changes in the poker industry. He criticized the growing reliance on short form and AI-driven poker content and expressed concern that more top professionals now feel pressured to create content simply to secure sponsorship opportunities. I have to say that on this, he really was preaching to the choir in terms of Dara and I. We've been saying similar things for a while. I actually think that if you have any creative bone in your body, the slop is such an affront to you aesthetically. And the idea of outsourcing either your thinking or your writing or your video making to an AI program is just awful. The flip side of that is that it's very fast and it fools at least some percent of the people who are watching clearly, maybe the few who aren't so discerning. In your response to Brad's video, there was a section that began with, "I don't like where some things are headed. I hate YouTube shorts. I hate voiceovers. I hate that a lot of people are promoting the game in a way that I don't think is healthy for younger people to see." Can you take it from there?
Sure. I mean, in terms of the YouTube shorts and the short video, there's two elements of it. One is kind of within the and AI and all that, and one is within the poker space, and one is within life. And yeah, I find that what has happened is people get very good at finding out what sorts of content goes viral. And then it become this game until that thing no longer goes viral for whatever reason, whether it's because the algorithm shift or whether it's because of just people get tired of things. You know, there's it's like fashion, whatever, there's cycles, there's ups and downs. And yeah, like I found it. You know, for instance, I grew up listening to a lot of like talk radio just in the car. I would listen to it before going to bed. And then when podcasts existed were created, I was like, hey, I love this idea that I can now just listen to like a radio show, except it's archived. I don't need to be listening to it live. People do these things. It was a very exciting thing. And then I slowly saw every podcast, this one, you know, included, it's not just that they had to become, it's that they became video based. It's that they had to become video based because they had to get on YouTube. And if you want to get on YouTube, you need to have video. And then I saw, well, how people talk about this. Well, how do you promote it? Well, people would never click on an audio clip. It needs to be a video clip. And then they're like, well, some people are scrolling their phone in public and don't want to listen to something. So then they need to have the captions that come up so you could read what the people are saying. And like it not only does it feel like, I say this as somebody whose attention is constantly diverted and frazzled and I'm trouble focusing on things, but I'm like, it would be nice if things were created in a way that were designed to like help me focus, and instead it feel things were designed to be like, we know you're not going to be paying attention to this, so we're going to give these big bold captions and like pink bubble letters so you could read along while you're like doing like three things at once, including watching this clip. So it's natural then, of course, that that would happen to poker content as well. I wrote in my thing, I don't believe, I can barely convince like friends of mine like this is a good restaurant or something. The idea that I could convince the world to change what sort of like content they were to is crazy, but I don't like it. I do find it to be very like it's designed to be stuff where it feels if the aesthetic and the design of something feels like it is meant for you to be consumed while you're doing something else, then I go, well, how much can the people making this have like cared about it? That part of my brain goes off where I'm like, well, if it's being presented to me in a way where it's like, it's like being sort of like caviar in a like a styrofoam takeout container. Like it's like, well, like I'm sure a lot of effort went into this, and I'm sure it's a luxury product, but it sure doesn't feel this way when I'm, lying on my couch eating it with a plastic fork. And yeah, so in that regard, I find it frustrating, especially with poker, because through this conflation sort of with that sort of short form content that sort of hits your dopamine centers and whatever, and then with the actual content. And then the actual content a lot is like, I'll be nice and I won't say names, but they're just people who are like basically like, if you try to like study poker like this, you're an idiot and you're stupid, and poker's really simple, and you do these like three tricks and like this will make you a bunch of money and you'll be a winner. And like I remember talking to Ike about somebody who had like a course, and Ike's point for the course was that like, oh, this person had like an hour on blind versus blind play. And like the implication was, hey, in an hour we'll teach you blind versus blind play. And Ike's like, I would need like 50 hours to teach somebody blind versus blind play. And that's the reality of it, that like a lot of the stuff does work, there is no easy fix. It's not quick and easy. It's very hard. And I find this combination between this aesthetic thing of, hey, while you're like sitting back on your couch, watch this Instagram reel with the captions on, in gigantic font, you don't even need to put your glasses on to read it if you don't want. And then the advice being given, which is like, don't worry, like I'll teach you the thing that will make you be a very good poker player. And one of the things I'm trying to do with Punt of the Day is kind of like brick by brick, day by day, is be like, it is just a lot of hard work and study, and you will hit roadblocks, and sometimes you learn just one little thing that unlocks everything. But if there were a simple trick that just turned any like, one big blind winner into a two big blind winner, that it just doesn't exist unless somebody's doing something like amazingly, unless somebody's like live straddling or something every orbit.
Yeah, to pick up on what you said, well, firstly, I love the image of you lying on your couch eating very nice fish eggs out of a styrofoam container. Actually, evokes that image of Paul Giamatti in Sideways drinking the really nice wine that he's been saving for years out of a big cup. But the other one is actually, and I don't know if this will lead me nicely to the next point I want Dara to make, but I remember, as a TV writer, like 20 years ago, when that's what I wanted to get into, there was a really big breakthrough had occurred a few years previous, which was that I think it was Michael Crichton had the pilot episode for ER, And nobody would make it because it was seen as too complicated, too many storylines, too many characters introduced, too fast paced. The audience would be thrown around. They wouldn't follow what was going on. And there was an assumption in the industry back then that audiences were thick, I suppose, and just couldn't follow multiple narratives or be thrown around and sort of have that experience of like wanting to catch up and wanting to watch it again to see what they'd missed or whatever. Whereas now we see in TV, really complicated, rich stories over multiple seasons that have loads of storylines, that have loads of character depth, that are much more like novels. And but you go back to like the late 90s, early 2000s, and that just wasn't perceived as something that could ever work. So I think maybe analogously, we're forgetting that like the audience aren't stupid and think that they're only able for this because, yes, of course, we've become very Instagram generation to call back to what Dara said, and that we're maybe everything has to be kind of fast and our attention is easily grabbed away. But I still think there's a market for long form podcasts, for seasons of TV shows that go on for like, 80 episodes. And I think our landscape has proven that there is that too, even if there is this enjoyment of short form as well. Dara, returning to you, I obviously said how Brad was preaching to the choir. We discovered this cultural shift firsthand during our time with WPT Global, who pushed sort of short form AI reels slop pretty hard at us. And I hate to say it, but they kind of ignored our actual strong suits, I feel, as authentic long form, content creators. Not wishing to belabor the criticisms of WPT Global, which I'm sure people are getting sick of from our mouths at the moment, but because there are obviously other sites that do this, and actually it's a cultural trend writ large. But can you talk about your major issues with companies leaning into this type of content and maybe ignoring the more complicated long form stuff?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, obviously, there are commercial realities and tastes shift over time. The way people consume content shifts. People who follow this show religiously know that I was lucky enough to have a almost daily correspondence with David Bowie for roughly 10 years. And Bowie was brilliant on this stuff. Bowie understood. Bowie used to always tell me that technology drives culture, not the other way around. And the way things are consumed is of super importance. Cinema is an all-encompassing experience. You go to the cinema, you're there, you have nothing else to think about. So movies could be quite complex. Television was always seen as well. People are at home, they're maybe not paying as much as close attention. So the ER thing that you talked about, but that got stood on its head. But unfortunately, actually in TV, if anything, it's going back the other way now. The latest thing that everybody's talking about is what they call second screen viewing, the assumption that everybody else is on an iPad or a phone while they're watching TV and therefore can't really follow complex plots or things anymore. So everything has to be kind of dumbed down and repeated constantly. In our space, there has been this push towards shorts and reels, and that's come from the view that certain content creators are reaching a much wider audience. Now, we have suspicions that that's at the very least overhyped and may not be the case. But people are sitting in companies making no distinction between somebody watching 12 seconds of a reel and somebody listening to a long form podcast like ours for 90 minutes. And they're kind of treating those two things as the same. And in fact, the way the technology works, anybody can go on Instagram and see, oh, that reel got lots and lots of views. It's not obvious to our audience even how many people consume each of our episodes. Sometimes when people ask me what the numbers are when I'm out at events, they're really surprised and they're like, oh wow, I didn't realize that so many people listen to you guys. Because there's no one figure, whereas you go on Instagram and you hover over it, or you go on Twitter and it says like 20,000 views or whatever. So that's kind of the way the corporates are currently sending it. But you are right, like people are still smart and people are I already feel that people are getting really tired of this stuff. And the everything is always reaction and counter reaction. Generally, everything new that comes up is popular for a while. The 30-second reels, and then beyond a certain point, people just get tired. However, the mobile phone is still the most important piece of technology in the world. And the mobile phone, what's better to look at on a mobile phone? A 30-second reel where the captions are there, as Sam said, you don't even have to listen to it, or a 90-minute long form podcast. Unfortunately for us, it is the latter. But there, I think one thing companies probably have to focus more on is sort of like depth of impact. Like, just because somebody is distracted on a commuter train and watches a 20-second reel, that has, that won't impact their future behavior the same way that somebody who listens religiously to a bi-weekly podcast for 90 minutes, such as ours.
Indeed. Well, back to you, Sam. Again, apart from like leaning into another bit of the response that you gave, you said it actually hurts me to see top level players like Jeremy Osmus, Seth Davies, and even Chidwick, to some extent, make poker content on YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram. Now, this is a slightly different point because you're specifically talking about the game's elite players starting to play the game. This harkens back to what Dara said about how the sort of the model of who gets ambassadorships shifted maybe a decade or more ago. Can you unpack your woes in this regard?
So the one thing I will say is, before talking from my perspective as a high level player, I will say I think part of the thing that with somebody like Brad, which is tough, is like he. I don't mean this in any sort of like negative way. He was savvy in this regard, but a lot of the reason why Brad was able to build his audience and get sponsorships to do things is he was ahead of the curve. And one of the things about any of the, whether you're the first person to stream on Twitch or the first, I remember when poker training sites did not exist, and the first people who created them, like with Card Runners, with Taylor Cabby or KB, I forget how it's pronounced, but and what inevitably happens, and it's also kind of the story of poker in some way, is people found a way to make money. Other people saw it, other people copied it. So what happened with Brad was part of the reason his YouTube, he was very successful on YouTube, and part of the reason he mentioned Andrew Neame and the meetup games was popular because he was the first guy. But as soon as you do something that's popular and make money, even if whether that thing is, streaming or whether that thing is being the first person to like I don't know, like min raise off 10 big blinds, people will copy it and people will figure it out. And when the way you're trying to make money is by gaining an audience in some way, if what you do is novel in some ways, it's a countdown until it's no longer novel and there's a bunch of imitators. I think what happened with the poker players like Jeremy and Seth and CV and myself, I think part of it is, yeah, having all of us have kids. Stevie has a kid. I have kid at the moment, but soon to be two. And it's a lot. Like I've said, if I didn't have if I did not have children, I would have probably gone to Cyprus for the Onyx series and then Paris, and then I'd be in Jeju right now. I would have spent like half the year at home. I would have been going all over, and it's hard. So my first point here is to say that, yeah, like this was inevitable. As soon as a path is sort of like laid out and it's lucrative, people will try to copy it. And then for the for I can't speak to Seth and Jeremy and Stevie, but I can make some assumptions and I could speak for myself. The idea of going, well, and we can even go back to Brad losing 400K, which is, I know you brought up the 50K, but I assume most of those 400K losses were kind of in 5 to 10K, maybe the 10K championships at the World Series. And going on a 400K downswing in 10Ks, even small field 10Ks, is just not that difficult. Then you sell into 25s, 50s, 100s, whatever. Like there's a lot, even if you sell action, even if you swap, you can still go in really big downswings. So the idea of like going into the year and going, okay, I know I can say at the beginning of the year that I will make, this much money from Octopi in the case of Stevie, or this much money from my YouTube channel, or this much money from my Substack, or whatever it is. it becomes a very attractive option because the idea of, me as an individual saying, oh, I'm going to, oh, I lost it all. I'm going to need to sell my house and eat ramen and figure it out. Versus being like, hey, sorry, we're not the for vacation this year, we're going to the backyard, telling like a family that's a very different thing. So yeah, like just as in poker, you see people kind of have these copycat strategies. People see how people are making money. I also think like poker, there's kind of a I don't know if I'm allowed to swear or not. I was going to say
Go for
no.
it.
Oh, I was going to say bullshit. It's not even like a not even like a 6 out of 10 swear word. But you look at poker and you go, oh wow, this person. You take like the top like 20 pros in a year and you go, oh wow, like this person won like $2 million this year. But then if you just average them out, you'd be like, oh, they averaged out, counted the losses, counted the wins, like to everyone making 400K a year or whatever the number is. And that's probably a little more reasonable. And it's like the same thing with the content thing where you look around and you go, oh, how much is Brad making? How much is like Faraz making? How much are all these people making? And then, yeah, then if you don't re because when you're on the sidelines, of course you kind of look at the people who are making the most and being the most popular and going, oh, that could be me. And if you're someone like me or Stevie or Seth who are, competitive people and have a reputation in poker and feel you can make good content, of course I would, my like instinct is going to be like, I'm going to be like Brad, I'm going to get a deal like this person. I'm going to do that because that's who I am. I am competitive, and I think my product is good, and I want it to, and I think it should be, the most popular, whether or not that's realistic or not.
Yeah, I'm now getting the converse image of somebody eating noodles, but out of the very expensive crockery they were able to buy when they had money a few years ago. Altogether, look, Brad's post offered a very rare and honest look into the realities of modern poker, the cruelty of variance, the feeling of burnout, the evolving economics of being a professional player in today's game. Fair play to him for writing that, and we wish him well going forward. Whatever he chooses to do, it feels like he is at one of those maybe crossroads in his life or in the game. From live poker to online poker now, Dara, you had the great privilege of playing at the same online table as a teen pro last Sunday, while I had the great privilege of battling with the Paddy Power Poker Ambassador. That is until you eliminated me, of course, a hand that I captured for posterity, and it was thrown up on social media a little later on. One beady-eyed watcher spotted my payout pop up as I bust and asked if it was a $10 tournament that we were both playing. It was, in fact, a $22 hyper tournament, which we both maxed late reg, as far as I know. Full disclosure, though, I did play three $11 games that night. So his point about the size of games that you might find me in was absolutely fair. Now, I still mass multi-table, not like I used to in my salad days, when I could do 40 tables handily enough, but I still play about 20. That night I played a buy-in range from $11 to €162, probably averaging around the $50 mark. But I was interested in the comment because I suspect the thrust of it was to shame me for playing so low, or actually shame both of us, Dara. That reminded me then of perhaps my favorite blog of yours from about 12 years ago called Boxes, when you eloquently broke down what the job of an online poker player really is. Dara, can you give a summary of that blog and maybe tell us the moral of the story?
Yeah, the basic idea behind the blog was the difference between the sort of recreational mindset of an online tournament and the professional. The recreational is thinking, okay, this tournament has a certain buy-in. The bigger it is, the better, because the more prestigious it is or whatever. And then they're looking at first prize and they're thinking, well, that's the amount I could possibly win in this tournament. And again, the bigger, the better. And typically what that leads to is, 4,000, 5,000 runner fields, which are obviously, we understand, a very high variance. The professional is kind of just thinking of each tournament as a box on his screen, a piece of real estate. And he's trying to fill up his screen with whatever number of boxes, in your case, 25, he feels he can adequately cope with. And he's thinking that each box has a certain expectation. If it's a $100 tournament where you have a 20% ROI that you believe, you're expecting in the long run to make $20 on that box. What the first prize is doesn't matter. None of that stuff matters. You're just taking the long-term view of this is going to make me $20 in the long run. Every box on the screen has to justify itself. And people used to ask me, why do you play the Big 11? And you play satellites for Super Tuesday, but you never actually play Super Tuesday. You just take the tournament money. And my argument was always like, if I have an edge in Super Tuesday, and that's not even clear, I wouldn't estimate it at more than 2 or 3%. So every time in my mind I play Super Tuesday, it's not, oh, I could win a few $100,000 in this tournament. It's no, in the long term, I'm winning $20 to $30 in this tournament. Every time I play the Big 11, I believe I have a massive edge in that. It might be 200 to 300%. So I'm also making $20 to $30. So I have a choice. I can play a $1,000 tournament, or I can play an $11 tournament. They're both making me the same in the long run. So it seems that from a bankroll management and everything other perspective, the $11 tournament is a much better, better option. And that was I remember when I wrote the blog at the time. The number of professionals who said, I guess it hadn't been enunciated in these terms before. They were like, "This is the blog that most resonated with me as a professional online player." I'd never really thought about it in those terms before, but it is completely true. And that's, unconsciously, that's the way online professionals who don't play the highest stakes, who grind at lower stakes, think every box has to make money. And I remember once having to explain to a student who was obsessed with playing free rolls that, like, how much are you actually making in this free roll? Like, okay, there's no buy-in, but maybe you're only making 50 cents. You could be playing an $11 tournament where you have 100% edge, where you're making $11. So you're actually costing yourself money playing this free roll without realizing it. And that was sort of that was the whole thrust of the blog, just to explain what the professional view of everything is just a box on a screen that has a certain expectation.
Yeah, it is still one of my favorite blogs, and I read it again there in preparation for this. And I think beyond even the ROI argument, which you've very well articulated there, the hourly argument as well, like max late regging a hyper when half the field are gone. And again, put to one side, we've argued against letting people max late reg as late as we can, but we're pros too, so we'll, while the sites still let you do it, we'll still do it. And a max late reg on a 22 hyper is actually pretty good hourly. Might even be a better hourly than playing that 100 from the start. Sometimes these max late regs on these tournaments can be really, really good ROIs. And because you're just thinking like, what's the average amount of time this will be on my screen? If you play 100 from the start, maybe on average it's going to be on your screen for 100 minutes. If you play the Hyper 22 max late reg, it might be on your screen like 10 minutes, like on average. And then you're calculating your ROIs from that, putting in the hourly factor. Sam, obviously you play high stakes. Is there a version of this within that community? Would a player who plays 100Ks get shamed for playing a paltry 1K live tournament, or I don't know, maybe a 100 quid game online?
Online, I think it's a different beast because people are just kind of like, well, you're at your computer, right? So once you're at the computer, it's like I remember at one point during, I was going to say, I believe the tournament was on a competitor, but I'll tell you it was during the scoop. And Ben CB was at my table in a 25K, and I pulled up his stream to see what he did, and I just saw that he was playing like some like $50 like knockout, like hyper turbo knockout or something, and I was just like, and then at the top of his Twitch stream it was like up like 800K this scoop or whatever, and I was just sitting there like, this fucking guy is, I'm here like four tabling at 25K playing the best poker I can play, and this guy's playing, if he's playing a $55 knockout, who knows how many other tournament, because the Twitch screen was cascading. I was like, I don't even know how many tables he's playing, but it's a lot. I think we're basically, there is an element, obviously, well, part of the reason people get into tournaments is, is because they're competitive and they like the competition and they like the thrill of like winning a trophy and the vanity of that to some degree and all that. So, and what's tough is to go, okay, that's a natural impulse. That's something that makes you competitive. That's like a fair way to kind of structure your poker life around what makes you passionate, what makes you interested. But you also don't want to tip to the point where it turns into pride, or vanity, and you end up making sort of reckless decisions. So to look at it from like another perspective, one thing I've been asked is like, well, why do you play 100Ks when there's a really soft 2K? And it's like, well, to me, the money is very clearly for me, to you, I say 100Ks and 2Ks to you, the very specific example, which is on day whatever of EPTs, they have the 2K high roller. Is it now a 3K? Could the open,
Yeah, they're 2700s now, but I know
27.
exactly the tournament you
Yeah, so
mean.
they had the 2K high roller of, say, in Spain, it was the Estrellas tournament or the Eureka tournament of Prague, and then they would run it concurrently with the super high roller. That's 100K or 50K. And it's like, well, if I'd say played at 100K, well, I took a 10K piece of myself, I swapped with five people for 2K each, I sold 80% of myself at 1.1 or 1.01. I'm like, well, then, okay, then I, before the tournament had started, I have $800 in my pocket and I have 20K in action that I think is somewhat diversified and like, and winning. So then I go, okay, well, how much would I need to be winning in the 2K to make it worth it EV wise? And it's like, well, I would need to have like a, I don't know, like a 300% ROI in the 2K maybe. I need some giant ROI that's not really realistic. And I'm using 1.01 as a, lower bound potentially for markup as well. So, and that's not, that's also like not even counting other things, which is at EPTs, well, if you play the 100K, you get three free nights of a hotel. So then you go, okay, get $800. And in a place like Barcelona or Monaco, I get 1,500 euros worth of hotels, and free food and stuff like that. So from an EV perspective, that if you're able to sell and control the size of your piece such that you aren't being financially reckless, the EVs are not close. What I think the issues are twofold right now, which is there's two things that have been kind of cracking. One is traditionally the relationship in poker tournaments has been the larger the field, the larger your ROI. And that's true because generally a bigger field means there's more weak players in the tournament, but also because just you have more hands to assert your edge. A heads up sitting go might end in one hand. The World Series of Poker main event will basically all, if the winner will basically always play like whatever, 10 to like 10,000 hands or something. Yeah, that seems about right. No, that's too much, but whatever. Yeah. You get what I'm saying. But it's more than one hand. And
I'd say they play about 3,000 hands, maybe.
yeah, I was good. Yeah. Anyways. And that's, so there's two problems there. One is as tournaments, as operators have chased big prize pools, the relationship between bigger fields being softer fields has totally fallen apart because the way they have chased big prize pools is making tournaments that have a million day ones and multiple re-entries, which I remember early on in COVID, Michael Adamo and Juan Pardo won the big $400 like Colossus tournaments that had like 10,000 people in it. And I thought to myself at first, like, wow, that's crazy. What are the odds that one of like the best players would win? And then I did some more thinking, and I'm like, oh, probably the top 100 players in the world might have put in like literally like 1,000 bullets in this tournament combined, And then you're like, then it starts making a little more sense. Then instead of it being a 1 in 1,000 shot, it's like a, like a 10% shot. And that's ignoring skill edge. But the other thing is what you should be op trying to aim for is not just the max EV or the max ROI, but the max bankroll growth. I don't know if you guys ever dabbled in daily fantasy sports, but at the VOA South, they had these $20 tournaments that were basically winner take all. They were called like the Millionaire Maker. First place would get $1 million. 10th place got like 10K or something. It was that extreme. And just for fun, I put it into like a Kelly Criterion calculator. And at the even if you have a 50% edge, they will basically like in order to like play this exclusively, like exclusively if your only way of making money or your only way of gambling, you would need like $2 million. You would need like a $2 million bankroll if you had a 50% ROI. And what I think is happening is people, it's much better for you to play a tournament where you have a, like, it's much better to play a small field tournament with a small ROI for bankroll growth than a big field tournament because it's just, there's just so much less VOA. It's, and back to me, part of what's happened with super high rollers is, it used to be that you would regularly play super high rollers with, say, 40 unique people. If you, say, again, played and swapped with five people, you would have a piece of maybe 15% of the field, which means odds are you would at least have one of your swaps cash the tournament. And if, you know, and it's, you know, a pretty decent chance that you or one of your swaps would win the tournament. And now it's at a point where it's like, okay, now there's, you know, in Trident JG last time I went, I came fifth in the main event, but it had 400 and something people. So suddenly this is not a kind of like low edge, low variance gamble. It's like a maybe medium, you know, maybe with all the new money coming in, the tournaments have gotten softer, but it's more of like a medium edge, high variance game. Like, you know, the edge has maybe gone up 2x as much, but the variance has maybe gone up 5x as much. So I think one of the advice I always give people when they ask like, hey, I'm a $20, $40 ABI player, what should I be playing? And I say, play the tournaments other people aren't playing. Like if you can make your life work around it, I could play like the graveyard shift, that's a great way to do it. But you can also do what other people like play on the weird sites. Play the tournaments without the big guarantees. Play the tournament the other people are skipping because, like a 10% ROI in a 100-person tournament is much, much better for long for your ability to stay in action than like a 20% ROI in a 1,000-person tournament. So, yeah, so like I that's my perspective of it. I did like the, I did read Dara's blog and I did like the box analogy because I think it comes from the same. We ultimately came to the same conclusion, which is like it's not about playing the brand name tournament. It's about playing the best tournament. But I would say that it's not just about the highest, like it's not just a simple function of ROI times buy-in, it's ROI times buy-in with some adjustment for field size. Will you give preference to smaller field tournaments?
Yeah, that's a phenomenal breakdown. What I would say is, for anyone who just listened to what Sam said there, do definitely play the weird little tournaments. Do definitely play the smaller fields. Don't play those weird sites. Don't play on those weird sites. Don't definitely don't do that.
Although,
Actually,
to be fair, Paddy Power is, you know. I know the corporate partners, I guess, that do Flutter, but Paddy Power might be Dara, give a sign up. Code Dara, paddypower.com.
Yeah, we don't do the push. We don't push the
You
code
don't have
tree
to do that anymore, thank
anymore.
God. Dara, I want to induce one little anecdote from you to finish off this topic. Ben CB was invoked there. Obviously, Ben CB, no love for me, it's fair to say. He's thrown a fair amount of mud in my direction in the last 2 weeks. But I give him a huge amount of credit for being that guy who'll play the 50 hyper while in the 25K. I think that's phenomenal. And it's actually something that you have noticed and have a story about, which speaks to, dare I say, a German mentality, or at least maybe an Eastern Europe or Central Europe mentality that differs from maybe other mentalities, Southern Europe, maybe other places too, about, you know, people being wanting to be defined by how big they'll play versus how small they'll play.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was quite early in my career, and as Sam was talking about, all of the thing and playing up what people don't want to play, my mind immediately went to our German friend Martin Mulsau,
Yeah.
who so much did that he actually invented a term for that type of tournament that other people weren't playing, the small field, no guarantee tournaments. He referred to them as bowl comps, bowl of rice up top, but incredibly profitable because regs stayed away from them back in the day. And I remember years and years ago, I was playing a small buy-in tournament on, actually Paddy Power it was, ironically enough, at the time,
God
and one
bless.
of Ireland's top players came on to me on MSN. This is how long ago that MSN was how we communicated back then, and he was essentially buy-in shaming me, saying like, you're supposed to be one of the biggest online winning players. What are you doing playing this 11 euro tournament or whatever it was? And that was very much the culture in Ireland at the time. Everybody wanted to play as high as possible. No, nobody would ever want to be seen dead in a tournament that was lower than a 109 online or a 1K alive. And if you did, you were, some sort of pathetic loser and clearly not doing as well as everybody thought you were doing. And even Busto, the whole Doak is, I think an actual Doak is Busto rumor started. Somebody posted on Twitter saying, look, he's playing this $11 tournament. He must be bust. And then on my very next live trip was somewhere in the UK for UK IPT. And I was on a table with Martin Mulsau, our friend. And there was a bunch of Germans, young Germans, railing him because Martin was seen as sort of the ultimate early German professional, the guy who, won all of the money in tiny little increments in these tiny little bowl comps. And I was just listening to the conversation on the rail between the guys, and the guys were saying, oh, I really like that $5 rebuy on Stars. That's such a good tournament. And the other guy was going, oh, I really like the $2 rebuy. That's a really good. They were trying to, like, not one up man, but one down manship each other of like, I go even lower. And I remember Martin looked up at the rail and goes, $2 rebuy. The $1 rebuy is where it's at. That's the best tournament. And the Germans were actually boasting about how low they were willing to go in pursuit of ROI. And I remember thinking at that stage, because Germany was not a good poker nation at that stage. People don't remember how bad the Germans were when they started. Every country has to go through a learning curve, and the German mentality, which was, very logical but also very predictable, actually made them very easy to play against back in the day. Over time, their sort of emphasis on discipline and education and study meant that they turned into, one of the crushing nations of Europe, but at the time that wasn't the case. But I remember thinking, yeah, the Germans are going to get there. The Germans are definitely going to end up with most of the money.
Brilliant stuff, brilliant stuff. Well, look, if people don't like the idea of me playing 22 hypers, they're really going to hate this next topic. Dara, as per your recollection, we met first on a Full Tilt 45 man, let's say circa 2010. We talked about this in a recent nostalgia piece for Patreon. I apparently abused you in the chat after a speculative shove with the worst hand that got there. In all honesty, I don't remember the specific hand, but I used to put people on blast all the time in the chat box. So story definitely checks out. For years online, multi-table sit and go tournaments like 45 mans, 90 mans, 180 mans were some of the most beloved games in online poker. They occupied a sweet spot between the quick resolution of a single table sit and go and the marathon grind of a huge MTT field. Yet around 4 or 5 years ago, most major sites phase them out in favor of faster, more lottery style formats. And in doing so, I think they genuinely cost poker something very valuable. I am the new kid at PokerStars, so I don't want to get too big for my boots yet, but I am ever so gently waging a campaign now to show the powers that be that these games should be introduced or reintroduced, I should say. Taking a leaf out of Barry's book, I've posted a bunch of memes and old screenshots, and the feedback has actually been pretty wild. It really does feel like these games are deeply missed. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think they are deeply missed. I absolutely love them. As soon as I discovered the 180 mans on Full Tilt, and the 45 mans as well, I thought, like, this is amazing. This is just such low variance money. And I do remember one of our first significant conversations. I ran very well over the first 500. I had a ridiculous ROI, and you told me that this was not long-term sustainable. Turned out you were right. But at the time, they were amazing games because they just fired up all the time. You could. We both started as sit and go players, one table sit and go players, which were even better because, you could You didn't have to do the long session. You could decide, I'm just going to do 3 or 4 hours. All of these games, unfortunately, were killed by spins. That's just the reality. I remember reading a Fintan Hand blog and watching Fintan on Twitch ranting about Stars at the time, saying you've just killed these games. You don't realize it yet, but you have. And unfortunately, all of the recreational money moved towards the spins. But from the professional perspective, those sort of games were absolutely perfect. They were low variance. You could grind them when you wanted. They just ran all the time. They were the training ground for a lot of MTT players. Unfortunately, as they died, we all had to move into the bigger field MTTs. To the point now that, when I talk to younger players who started afterwards, like everybody who's an MTT reg now that I know who started after, say, 2015, started in MTTs. They started in the thousand runner fields, and they have no recollection of that there was anything other than spins that was an alternative.
Yeah. Sam, to bring you in on this one, not only were those games great bankroll builders offering that bridge that we mentioned between single table games and MTTs, but as a person who relied on these games to get my start in the game, one aspect of it was how they created a sort of a pool where you constantly met familiar opponents, and therefore it did give you a place to work on your exploitative skills versus certain weaker players, your exploitative skills against certain better players, because none of us were GTO back then, of course. And that essentially is what poker is. It's that adjustment game, and reacting to table dynamics and reacting to pools and villains you're familiar with, etc., etc. As someone who plays in small enough pool yourself, albeit at super high roller level, can you relate to this in that way?
Yeah, for sure. No, I think one of the things that happens when you see guys kind of like new blood and super high rollers is everyone kind of has the tricks that work in their games. And then they're like, okay, well, what happens once people start seeing your tricks and start like adjusting to them over and over, you know? And some of the it's as simple as this guy's always bluffing, I'm never folding to this guy. And then you go, okay, let's see what happens when you have like a trident or something with like a guy who just has a week of none of his bluffs ever working, because people adjust. So I think that's kind of one of the things that's fun about super high rollers is that they have a small player pool, which means you have this, the long form game of poker where when you're playing with total unknowns, everyone just kind of had their little tricks. And, they work insofar as they were like aligned with kind of like the population. Meta. As for multi-table sitting goes, generally, I guess one of the problems will be that they wouldn't run on demand. There isn't enough liquidity on the sites to run them on demand like they used to. Somebody DM'd me on Instagram telling me that they're playing a format on GG, which are two table sitting goes, that after a specific amount, that's a two table sitting go with a mystery bounty. And then the mystery bounty format begins at the final table,
Yeah, I've played those.
and then with like 10 people, if after a certain amount of time, if they haven't played down to a final table, they just force the short stacks to go blind all in with each other. So that's not quite a multi-table setting go like you're talking about, but I think the way to do it would be instead of doing them as on-demand tournaments, you do them as capped tournaments. So I don't know if it will work. I don't know if they'd get popular, but I would be like, hey, this tournament will get capped at this many people, which means that the tournament will end at, that's how I would kind of like structure will go. It's a freeze out. That would be the marketing push, I think of it. It's a freeze out. There's no rebuy, no re-entries. And then the tournament every day it starts at, noon, and it's 180 people and should end around whatever, 2 or 3. I
I
think.
like that. I like the idea of like maybe it can kick off with 18. It's freeze out. It's not an egregious late reg, so there's a cap of when it'll be cut off time wise, but also a cap of numbers that if it does flood in to get
Yeah.
90, say it's a 90 man, then it stops there too. That's really nice, actually. Yeah, I like that as well.
Yeah.
Dara, to bring you back in, apart from myself and yourself, players who came from these games include Seth Davies, Setherson back in the day, Soheb Poorbonderwalla, McLean Carr, Fintan Hand, who you mentioned, Griffin Benger, Ben Willinovsky, Ryan Franklin, Hit the Panda. Casey, Jonathan Beck, Big Dog Pocket Fives, Mickey Peterson, just to name a few there, very famous names in the online world. And actually, I did go back through all the leaderboards there used to be on Sharkscope and found all these names. It was really fun. Actually, PokerStars head of live events, Cedric Bio, Guns and Aces 75 was there as well. So shout out to Cedric. The best thing about these games for me was threefold. Firstly, you made loads of final tables every day, so you got loads of practice at applying ICM principles. That was really cool. Secondly, because you made so many final tables, you weren't really precious about them. There was no subjective value of the money fear factor. You weren't playing suddenly something that was like bankroll changing. You were in a comfortable place. And thirdly, as a winning player, you actualized your ROI pretty much on a monthly basis. A point of pride for me in the early days of my career was that I only had one losing month in my first 60 months playing online poker professionally, and it was all thanks to this circuit. That is essentially the argument from a full-time player's perspective. However, and Dara, I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on this one. So many of the comments that I've received in the last like week or so, and there have literally been over 100 of these, which is telling me that there's a lot of love out there for them. A lot of those players were recreational. Can you talk about why there were like why these games are not just good for someone like me or you, but they're the perfect games for someone coming in after work looking to play for a few hours while the match is on in the background or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's the time constraint element. I talked to, some of the recreational players I coach don't actually play online all that much, and the reason is they can't commit 10, 12, 14 hours to a session. Now you can get around that by playing on sites where the fields are lower. Like Paddy Power Poker, for example. But you can also, I mean, this is why spins have been so popular, because they're short format, you can win a lot of money. The downside of the tournament is you can't necessarily win a huge amount of money, and that is what attracts a certain percentage, at least, of recreationals. They kind of just look at the first prize and they imagine winning that, and that determines whether it's a tournament they want to register. Not just recreationals, incidentally. Chris Moorman said once that he just looked at the first prize too, and he wasn't interested in playing any tournaments where the first prize was less than a certain amount. So he'd happily play an $11 tournament if there was 50 grand up top, but he wouldn't play a 1K if there was only 20 grand up top. So it's different strokes for different folks, but I think they've been away for long enough now that they also have a certain maybe novelty element to them. I mean, the worry, particularly about the one table sit and goes, and the real reason why one table sit and goes died, is it's almost a solved format. People got to the point where they were playing very, very close to perfectly. But the same is true of spins. Like, spins are actually a solved format, and still people will play them. So yeah, I mean, recreations do like the idea that they only have to play for a couple of hours, and also the final table experience is something that they, you said we don't get too precious about them, or we didn't get too precious about them back in the day because we made 10 final tables a day, but they do get that sort of buzz of, oh, I made a final table, even if it's only in a 45 man.
Exactly. Well, look, I promised to lobby PokerStars on this one, but in the meantime, if you want to play some huge field multi-day games, basically the opposite of these 90-mans, which of course have huge appeal because of the huge prize pools and prestige, Scoop is ongoing right now. There is another almost 2 weeks to go in that series, which guarantees 45 million. I would also say that if you enjoy playing Scoop on a Sunday, please make room for the Irish Open Mega Satellite guaranteeing 25 seats, but actually generating like 40 to 50, mark my words on that. At roughly the same time, you could play the Irish Open Satellite on Paddy Power too. But Dara, tell me about how that one is structured differently.
Well, Paddy has a number of different ways you can get in. There's a 50 rebuy add-on most nights. That's I think most weeknights except Thursday. It's a 10 rebuy add-on. So they're catering for different levels of buy-in. But the one which is generating the most seats is a 150 buy-in, and there are 15 euro feeders to that, and those day ones run pretty much several times a day all week, and they feed into a weekly final where there are 15, 20, 30 packages, actually, not just seats. And with the way the structure works, the 50 rebuy add-on, the 10 rebuy add-on, the add-on is several times bigger than the initial stack. So, I tell people, full disclosure, the best way to play these is just max late reg and take the add-on. You're getting more chips for a lower cost than the guy who goes in and fires lots of bullets and maybe doesn't even make it to the add-on. And then for the 150s, there are so many feeders running. I play the 150s religiously, but I've never actually bought into a 150. I come into the 15 feeders, and they're 15 rebuy add-on as well with the same format. And because it's basically like a 30 € tournament to a 150, where you're getting an ICM boost if you come in late, plus you're getting your chips cheaper. I'm effectively, my conversion rate in those is roughly 50%. So I'm getting into the 150 for €60 every time. And that's kind of what you should be aiming to do as well if you are grinding those. So yeah, lots of different routes in. And the 10 rebuy add-on one is an interesting one too, because that overlays every week as well. There's one seat guaranteed, but a lot of people have to chuck in a tenner to get to 1150, and it hasn't quite reached the number yet. So that's value for a different reason.
Great stuff. And speaking of Paddy Power, actually, Dara, you guys have another exciting promotion right now involving 30 packages to Las Vegas over the next 10 weeks. I think they can be won in three different ways. Can you give me some more details on
Yeah, I'm impeccably prepared here, obviously. So I'm checking
that?
my phone for the message from Brian. So yeah, basically it's for a Las Vegas package, and the Las Vegas package includes 7 nights stay for you and a guest at the 4-star hotel Planet Hollywood, which we know well on the Las Vegas Strip. Runs from the 13th till the 20th of June. You also get £1,000 credited to your Paddy Power account to cover your flight costs. Maybe that won't cover it in t by the time we get there, but we'll that's what's currently being allocated. And then $1,000 in cash to cover expenses, poker in Las Vegas, and you get food vouchers. There's a welcome party as well and a leaving party. There's three different ways you can win. There's a Nike Stack Builder, which are basically $5 sats with two packages guaranteed every second Sunday. The idea is you can play more than one flight and your stacks are combined. There's a twister to Vegas, the best 20 twist results over the week. And you can reset after five twisters, capped at €10 twisters. And first is a package, and the top 30 are paid. And then there's also a cash leaderboard. If you basically finish high up on the cash leaderboard, you also first every week gets a package, top 30 paid as well.
Awesome.
An important thing, and this is something we've talked about recently on the show, you can only win one package. So if you have already been lucky enough to win a package, don't try and win another one.
Very good. And before we let you go, Sam, do you remember the first live event package you ever won?
Yes, I do. I have a good story about this, which is so my brothers, this all took ties into kind of bankroll management edge conversation we were having. Leo, but my brothers both qualified for the PCA. I would have been just turned 18 at the time, so I was born in 1988. So do the math. And they both won packages, and then I was at the time playing $100 sit and goes on PokerStars and PolyPoker and stuff like that. And they had these $162 double shootouts to a PCA package. And I thought, well, I'm playing $100 sit and goes, so I can also play these $100 sit and goes. Now, or $160 sit and goes. Now, I don't need to tell you that a 9-man tournament that plays three people is slightly different bankroll requirement wise than a $162 tournament where 81 people enter and one wins. So I'd lost like, I don't know, like 4K, and then like whatever it was, it wasn't even like a mathematically like a notable downswing in any way, you know? It might have been something where if you won the first, whatever, it might have been something where if you won like your first sit and go, you got maybe got like your buy-in back or something like tiny like that. And then they had a giant $700 mega. I had like a 10K bankroll at the time, but I was like, they're both going to the Bahamas. What am I going to do? Not go? So I play the $700 mega, and I'm in my dorm room in Quebec, in Montreal. So you're allowed to drink in the dorms because everyone is of age. And there was a party going on in the dorm, like a keg, like 2 floors beneath mine. So I was like, okay, I'll meet you down there once I am done playing. And we get in the bubble, and I don't know how many people qualified, but my monitor full with every other table. And there was something like 80 seats were paid out, and I was like 40th. 75 seats were paid out, and I was 40th out of 70, or 40th out of 80. So I knew that I had it locked up. Now I know, I could have left my computer. People would have bought, five people would have busted. It was 2006 or whatever. People would have busted. But to me, this is like the crazy stake. So I know the correct strategy is to just keep folding, but the pressure and the stress is so much that I'm just watching the lobby, and I'm seeing me go from like 40th to 41st to 42nd, all the way down. But it doesn't matter. Again, the stacks will get blinded all in before mine. And I just remember somebody getting all in with a big stack, shoving or raising with Jack 8 suited, getting called by aces, and the flop was like 9-7-5-2 clubs. And I'm like, okay, done. We got this. It's over. And the board breaks out, and I was like pounding my desk, so mad. And then, of course, like 8 minutes later, I just got in the money. And I had enough chips where I could have like folded for like 2 whole orbits, and I needed like 2 people to bust and like five and like 10 people at shorter sacks than me. Like the It would have been impossible, but yeah, that was the first event I qualified for.
Nice, nice. Congrats on that one. That sounds like a great way to have kicked off your
Yes.
live career. It remains for me to thank you very much, Sam Greenwood, for being our guest this week. Really appreciate you stopping by.
Yes, a quick plug.
Oh, I was
So,
about to do a plug for you, but go on, you do it yourself.
well, no, I will tell you, so we're closing it on the 1 year anniversary of Punt of the Day. So there will be a 1 year discount. Code. I'm sending it to Lappin right now. It is www.puntoftheday.com/2026. Pretty easy to remember. And for that, they will get 26% off. In addition to that, this coming Sunday the 5th, or Saturday the 14th, Pi Day, I will be running a survey, asking for feedback for subscribers, non-subscribers, whatever. And in that survey, there will be an even heftier discount code for 30% off, but I'm going to make you put in the work for the 4%. So if you're subscribing, it's a 10-question multiple choice survey, so you can either sign up using the code I sent David, which he can post in the show notes, or you can sign up for the other one. And for those who don't know, it's just every day, there's now an archive of 200 and what are we at today? 248 posted today. So there's an archive of 248 sort of like essay, strategy, lesson articles where I write about a hand, mostly usually hands I played, but occasionally kind of big viral hands that other people played. And I go through what I was thinking during the hand, what I got wrong. Sometimes some tangents about things about the poker industry. And yeah, so you could subscribe. If you don't want to spend the money, I think it's great value in the poker content space, but if you become a free subscriber, there's still a ton of free content, including 3 free posts a week and some other stuff. So yeah, so like and subscribe, all that. You don't want me writing a post. In a year from now, I'll be writing a post like Brad Owen on Twitter, where I talk about how much money I've made, how much I'm burnt out because I lost all this money at poker, but I'm still making a ton of YouTube and ambassador deals and all that.
Well, look, firstly, I really appreciate a guest who does their own plugging. Thank you for that, and we will make sure it's in the show notes. And secondly, just to reiterate, it's an amazing resource for people. If you don't know about it already, what rock have you been hiding under? If you're aware of it but haven't subscribed, you really should. It's a wonderful resource for players, and just an insight into the mind of one of the greats in the game. I really do appreciate everything you do, and the few times we've managed to collaborate on a few hands over the year as well, also much appreciated. Dara, thank you very much as well.
Yeah, thank you. I was about to reiterate, so I guess I'll reiterate it. But on our academy, one of our academy members had a hand featured on the on the putter there recently, and you know it had a massive impact in our in the group. It's an amazing resource. People, so many people love it. So definitely sign up for it if you haven't. I will finish with a plug as well, as is the as is our want these days, is absolutely Shameless Shills. This time not for anything Paddy Power or PokerStars or anything else, but we've been talking about Brad Owen throughout the course of this episode, and Brad is actually coming to Ireland for his first meetup game next week on 20th of March in JP's club in Tallaght. Brad, who is very much the king of the meetup game, is coming. I was hoping to go to along to that myself, you know, big fan of Brad's. But we'll be away in Seville, unfortunately, so we won't be there. But yeah, definitely anybody who can get to that game should go. Brad always puts on a great meetup game.
He certainly does. Well, on that note, thank you so much, Sam Greenwood.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Dara.
Thank you. And also, Jason Tompkins is involved in running that meetup game. And Jason told me, under threat of death, to make sure that I told people they have to sign up through Poker Lens if they want to play in that meetup game.
Good advice. Go do that, guys. On that note, take care, everyone. Thanks so much.